Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 78 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, my guest is Dr. Brent Vine, a professor emeritus of classics and Indo-European studies at UCLA. His published research addresses a broad range of topics in the study of the ancient Indo-European languages and their reconstructed ancestor, Proto-Indo-European. Most of this work concerns phonological, morphological, and etymological problems related to the linguistic background of Greek, Latin, and Vedic Sanskrit, with forays into other areas such as classical Armenian, Phrygian, Germanic languages, and Old Russian. For many years, in parallel with his appointment in the UCLA Department of Classics, he served as head of the UCLA Program in Indo-European Studies, where he held the A. Richard Diebold, Jr. Chair of Indo-European Studies. In this episode, we discussed how linguists divide their field into subfields and periods, the development and importance of meter to both Homeric poetry and other forms of Greek poetry, and whether the Greeks had an ancient equivalent to Shakespearean English. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy!
Great. Thank you so, so much for joining me this morning for you, I guess, as you're in Japan, which is exciting. But I want to start us off with what I hope will be a fairly easy question, which is, when did you discover your interest in linguistics?
Yeah, that actually is an easy question, because there was a specific point where that happened. It happened when I was an undergraduate, and I was a classics major, so I was doing Greek and Latin literature, having had lots and lots of Greek and Latin before I got to college. I actually started Latin in seventh grade, and then I added Greek in 10th grade. And so by the time I got to college, the natural thing was to become a classics major. But as a sophomore, I took a course on the history of the Greek language, and that was just incredibly fascinating to me. And that was really the point at which I began to realize that although I deeply loved classical literature and continued to work with it in various ways, it was really the languages themselves, Greek and Latin, that really excited me. And so I followed that up the next year with the corresponding course on the history of the Latin language. And that kind of sealed the deal. So from that point, I realized that this is really what I wanted to do.
I think I had a fascination with the languages, and a ton of friends also coming through college did as well. But I don't think any of us had a good grasp of what studying linguistics itself was. We just kind of assumed it was just part of, oh, okay, you learn the languages and kind of how to construct them when you're learning them, and then it'll help you with English. And, you know, can you tell us a little bit more, like, so what goes into the decision if you do love classics and the history part, but like what would be the thing that pushes somebody to focus more on the linguistic aspect rather than just taking the languages part of the bigger picture of studying the classical world?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's kind of another angle to this whole question in a way, in terms of my own developing interests in this material. And that had to do with the types of study that get done by professionals in the field. So when you're studying literature, say you're reading, you're reading a play of Sophocles or something, and all kinds of interesting discussion questions come up. Why did the plot get structured in this way? What do you think about this or that character, and so on? Part of the attraction in some ways of humanistic study is that there's no right answer to many of these questions. There can be five different answers to questions about character and dramatic construction and so on, and they could all be right in different ways. That was becoming a little frustrating for me. And when I got to taking these courses in the linguistic side of Greek and Latin, it became clear that actually there are questions and there are answers. And you can investigate a question and you can arrive at a solution, which is either right or it's wrong. And this was very attractive to me, even though I'm not oriented towards math at all. I'm terrible with actual math, but the idea of problem solving in a way that one can do with linguistic study and that you really can't do in quite the same way with other types of humanistic research was very attractive to me. So that's just one important angle that I wanted to mention. The other thing, to follow up on your question a little bit more, is that there is a big difference between general linguistics or synchronic linguistics, as it's sometimes called, which is the study of language in general or the study of languages as they exist at given time periods. Difference between that and historical linguistics or diachronic linguistics. And when I took these courses on the history of Greek and the history of Latin, these were, of course, diachronic linguistic approaches to the languages. And although, of course, you can't really separate the two in all respects, still the focus on the historical background of the languages was more appealing to me. I was more interested in learning, you know, where did these languages come from and how did they develop, rather than detailed questions about the nature of the grammar, let's say, of Greek or Latin at a given time. Although that's very important and kind of enters into anything you do in certain ways.
It's so interesting, and I love how that there are those two angles that I don't think we properly consider unless we talk to someone who does know this information, and I wish more people did so they could better inform us, because I just from what you're saying, it sounds like I might have had a friend who might have maybe been a little more at home in linguistics than proper classics, but of course she didn't know, so she became a classicist anyway. It's interesting to hear you describe languages this way, also because as someone who also is not very good with math, I've heard definitely from a few people now that trying to unpack ancient languages is sort of like you can do it in a very, I don't want to say like mathy way, but there is some sort of process where it becomes like a giant equation that you can sort of start to unpack and see how things developed. So I just, that is something that was sparked in my mind when you mentioned that. And I also wanted to mention that. So I thought that was kind of cool. And I think just for my own knowledge, and maybe people in my audience might not know as well, is I think when there's the perception that when you say, you know, oh, I study linguistics and I study ancient languages, I think the something that pops into my head immediately is, oh, okay, so when, you know, when you say linguistics, are you studying the development of, like, ancient Greek, starting with, you know, the Minoans all the way to when people started to speak Latin, when the, you know, Romans came in. And so I'm wondering if you could explain to us a little bit about, you know, for your subfield, like, how do you section off the periods in which to study, or the parts of development?
One of the most exciting for me features of studying the history of Greek and Latin is that it's extremely important to study the oldest attested documents in both languages. And this was one of the things that was kind of eye-opening to me when I was taking these courses. For example, on the Latin side, classics departments, when you study literature, well, you know, there's typically a focus on the great authors of the Augustan period. Maybe sometimes there would be you'd have a chance to take a course on an author or one or more authors who was working in an earlier period, say an author like Plautus or Terence, getting back into the period called Early Latin, where the language is pretty much the same in most respects, but there are a lot of differences because, after all, it's, you know, it's 100, 200 years earlier than Caesar and Cicero, and things have happened to the language. Okay, but when you study the historical background of Latin, you have to go back even farther, and you have to look at ancient inscriptions in Latin that go back even to, in some cases, the 6th and 5th centuries BCE. So we're talking a half millennium before Cicero, let's say. And in some of these documents, well, the Latin is so different from ordinary classical Latin that literally some of it still cannot be understood. There are still some mysterious features of Latin that's that early that scholars are still trying to puzzle out. This is one aspect that for the study of Greek and Latin linguistics, you need to go back as far back as you can go in the documentation and see some very interesting material, depending on your interest, the kinds of studies you might be taking up. Sure, you would then go ahead and study the development of the language in all of its periods, as far as you want. So I've sometimes taught a course on Vulgar Latin, which basically means late Latin, the stage of Latin just before it was developing into the Romance languages. And that's extremely interesting, too. That's another type of linguistic study that one can undertake. So you can study the nature of the language and how it develops at any period. It is very important for the type of historical linguistics that was most exciting to me to go back and look at that really, really early stuff. On the Greek side, the obvious sort of material that one would think of is Homer. For people working on Greek linguistics, Homeric language is extremely important as the earliest documented type of literary language that we have. But we also have Mycenaean Greek. And so this has become a kind of a strong area of interest for me, is the study of this really, really early form of Greek that goes back to about 1400 BCE. Again, well, now we're talking about half a millennium before, or so, before Homer. Amazingly interesting and precious documentation of an earlier version of the Greek language. You've got to go back as far as we can, and Mycenaean Greek is it on the Greek side.
Well, as a linguist, I must ask, do you think we will ever be able to fully understand and decode Linear A tablets that we have? I know that I think people say, oh, no, I think it's just too old. We're not going to be able to crack that code. But in your opinion, do you think we might be able to?
There's actually a certain amount about Linear A that's known. A number of the symbols that are used in spelling Linear A words are the same as symbols used in spelling Mycenaean Greek. So there's a certain amount of overlap in the writing systems. For that reason, well, we can see in some Linear A tablets what the topic is under discussion. We know the meanings of some words, like we can see that there is an inventory of food products that are being listed. And then at the end, there's a word that means total, we can see, and then there's a number. A certain amount can be interpreted in the Linear A texts. Questions still remain as to the affiliation of the language. What kind of a language was it in terms of its grammar, and was it related to any other ancient languages that we know about? All of that kind of thing, as far as I'm concerned, is still very unclear. I don't want to say that we'll never know some of the answers. There's not a lot of clarity about a lot of features of Linear A, although some things we do understand.
Well, I'm going to just keep hoping that maybe we can get there. But I am very happy that we have made a lot of advancements, and we know more now than we ever have before. So we're trending in the right direction. But I want to turn a little bit to, so you've mentioned Homer, which, yay, I love Homer, obviously, as a classist, I love Homer. But so for just general audiences, some people definitely are aware that not only was Homer extremely unique in his style, but then, you know, you have to recite it. Well, you don't have to, but it should have been recited in meter. I've definitely come across people who've said, you know, well, was this the norm? Why was it in this specific meter? Were more things meant to be recited this way? Why do we only sort of hold Homer's works up and point to it and say, ah, yes, example, here we go. So as someone who's worked a bit with meter, you know, can you tell us what's so special about meter and Homer?
Actually, this is an area that I happen to get very interested in, that is the study of meter. And I ended up doing some work on meter in Sanskrit as well as in Greek. In fact, the question about the background of the Homeric meter, namely the dactylic hexameter, is fascinating and in some ways very controversial. There are basically two sorts of positions. One position, which actually goes back to some of the earliest serious studies of work on Greek meter, and I'm talking about work by Antoine Meillet, who was the figure who really established the whole possibility of reconstructing information about Indo-European, that is Proto-Indo-European meter. He looked at the dactylic hexameter of Homer and saw so much that was so different from Sanskrit meter and from the aeolic meters of Greek lyric poetry, which are very similar to Sanskrit meter, that he kind of threw up his hands and said, well, this is just not Indo-European. It probably was borrowed from some other culture, maybe like the Minoans or something like that, which basically says, well, we have no idea where this meter came from. Might have traveled around the ancient Mediterranean and gotten picked up by Greek speakers at some point, but that's all we can say. So that's one approach, which is not very satisfying. The other approach that has developed in a big way in recent times is kind of the opposite. And it provides analyses of the dactylic hexameter that do take it back to various forms of Proto-Indo-European meter. Well, there are several different versions of this, but one of the most popular, the basic kind of approach that I think is most promising, is the one according to which the dactylic hexameter is actually a combination of two shorter lines, something like, say, an 8-syllable line and a 7-syllable line. And when they got sort of strung together, you end up with what looks like a single line of about 15 syllables. And then you repeat that line in sequence, and you can produce, if you work out various permutations, you can produce the dactylic hexameter. So in a nutshell, I think actually we are arriving at some clarity. We at least have a number of attractive theories about the possible Indo-European background of the dactylic hexameter, so that we can kind of make some sense of how it developed, how it started, and how it developed in Greek. I think that's what you're asking is a really important question that really has gotten a lot of attention in scholarship in the past past few decades.
Well, I'm excited that I sort of tripped into that one then, since I'm not really in linguistic circles. I'm always really on the lookout, let's say, for hot topics of debate within a lot of different subfields. And like, I find it fascinating, and I think a lot of people would be fascinated in it too. It's just, it's hard because we don't tend to, you know, go out and shout about, and here's the latest hot topic discussion. But I'm really glad that I learned about this one. I had no idea. I thought, you know, oh, okay, well, we talk about dactylic hexameter with Homer, and that's great, and okay, it's special, and I thought that was that. So I'm really happy that you've been able to sort of come and explain what really is going into this. And that kind of leads me into my next question, which is, I just got back not too long ago from studying in Greece, and I took some modern Greek so I could go and at least learn to sort of make my way when I was living there. But having had my background in taking some ancient Greek and noticing the differences, I don't think a lot of people realize how different modern and ancient Greek are. And so as someone who's studied, you know, where they come from in this development, you know, can you tell us a bit more about, like, why is ancient Greek so different from modern? Because I think people just assume, oh, well, if you've learned one, then learning the other one should be super easy because it's all Greek.
I have to preface this by saying that I have not spent a lot of time working on modern Greek, although I know some things about modern Greek and about how the language developed in post-classical times. Now you're getting into a very general topic, which is the question about what linguists refer to as the universals of language change. The fact is that all languages are constantly changing. And as I sometimes tell my students, all you have to do is kind of think about things that you say that that are different from what your parents said, and things that your parents say that you wouldn't be caught dead saying. Languages are undergoing change all the time in all respects. So that includes the sound system and the grammar. You know, in a language like Greek, that means things like case endings and verb endings, all of that, sentence structure, phrase structure. All of this potentially is subject to change over time. Now, some languages seem to change more rapidly than others. It's something that linguists can't really predict, is the rate of change, but the fact of change is absolutely certain. We have continuous documentation over maybe a longer period than for any other human language. If you start from Mycenaean Greek and go up to the modern age, we're talking thousands of years of continuous documentation. And so, not surprisingly, lots and lots of change has occurred to the language. Already in ancient times, things were happening that lead to some of the features of modern Greek. So, for example, when students study classical Attic Greek, for the letter upsilon, you're taught to pronounce it kind of like a French U sound or a German U with umlaut. So for an upsilon, you're supposed to, you know, use a U type of pronunciation. But that actually is a relatively new development during the classical period. In earlier times, it was actually an ordinary U sound. So that change already happened by the time of classical Attic. And that's a kind of precursor to what happened to the rest of the vowel system, where a whole series of vowels ended up with the pronunciation E. So as you know from modern Greek, there are lots of vowels that actually all sound like E. And so that's something that developed already starting in late classical times and into the Byzantine period and then on into the modern period. So the whole vowel system has changed, which means the pronunciation of words that might even be spelled essentially the same as they are in ancient Greek, they get pronounced rather differently in modern Greek. And so similarly with any other part of the language you want to think of, say the case system. Well, Proto-Indo-European had 8 cases. Classical Greek only has 5 cases. So big change. Modern Greek, well, they've whittled that down a little bit more. So it's the same thing. So as long as you have a sufficient period of time, then the language is going to change. And we can at least say that some types of changes, like changes in pronunciation, changes in grammar, changes in syntax, are inevitable. It's just a matter of, when it's going to happen and how it's going to happen.
So this sparks an idea that I had. It was born out of a conversation I had with a colleague of mine. And I was going along and we were just trying to have a conversation about the differences between ancient and modern, and I was pronouncing things, and I remember he remarked, "Oh, well, you've got quite a modern pronunciation there." And I said, "Well, it's basically the same word, but I guess I'm doing a more modern sound." And then we sort of got onto this topic of, you know, accurate, quote-unquote, pronunciation. And I just remember, you know, in the spirit of a nice debate, he just said, "Well, I think to be more accurate, if you're using it in the ancient way, you should say it with the ancient pronunciation." And I said, "Oh, well, I mean, I guess, but even the one you learned probably changed a lot from what it was before. So can we even say it's accurate? Can we say it's more accurate to that era?" Neither of us are linguists, so we kind of left it there and just said, "Okay, well, I'll pronounce it this way and you can do it that way." But because of this change, this constant evolution, can we ever really say something is accurate? Because I know a lot of people like to go around these days and sort of armchair critique people and say, "Oh, well, you know, in this thing, they pronounce this differently, so therefore it's wrong." Or this one, they use, you know, this error's pronunciation, so that one's right. Is this sort of just, we do it because we need to find something to relate it back to base ourselves? Because can we ever really call something completely accurate?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's, again, something that comes up a lot in my teaching. When we talk to students about ancient Greek and Latin, even when I teach beginning Greek or Latin, which I've done, the question of pronunciation obviously comes up, and there's always a question. Well, how do you know what they were saying? How do you know how they actually pronounced these languages way back in those days? Well, the answer is actually we do know quite a lot, and it's fascinating to think about the different types of evidence that we have about how these ancient languages were actually pronounced. And I'll get to that in a second, but I want to also say that there are some little areas, little pockets of interest where we don't know the answer. So we know a lot about how ancient Greek pronunciation was like, what it was like, and similarly about Latin at various periods, but not quite everything. So this kind of gets back to the problem-solving approach that I talked about earlier. It's a question for which there are some definite answers. And so I can say, if I listen to somebody pronounce let's say, classical Latin, reading a text of Caesar or something, I can say, that's wrong. That person doesn't know how it was actually pronounced. And we do know. So just to go back quickly to the question of evidence, there's actually quite a lot. Some of it comes from ancient grammarians themselves. So there were ancient linguists, we might as well call them linguists. They were interested in the languages that they were speaking, whether Greek or Latin. And they went to some trouble to talk about it and write about it. And sometimes for pronunciation, they were extremely detailed and, as far as we can tell, accurate in coming up with these phonetic descriptions that any modern phonetician would be able to interpret in a reasonable way. We have a lot of information from the ancient grammarians themselves about how to pronounce their language that's readily interpretable. And so we need to make use of that to figure out what they were actually doing. Another type of evidence comes from the study of inscriptions. I mentioned these very ancient Latin inscriptions before, but we have inscriptions in both Greek and Latin from various periods. And the great thing about inscriptions is that they never went through a process of editing and copying the way all of our ancient manuscripts did. So when we read Cicero or Aeschylus, we have this really bad situation where the original manuscript that was written by these great authors is nowhere. And all we have is copies of copies of copies of copies and lots of mistakes entered into the process because the monks in the monasteries were sometimes even ignorant of the languages and working in poor lighting conditions. And we end up with these really messy manuscripts that have to be cleaned up. Well, we don't have that situation with inscriptions because we've got the thing itself, the way they actually spelled it. And often they were spelling words the way they pronounced them. So we can look at some spellings on inscriptions and say, oh, so that's what they were doing when they were pronouncing such and such a word. Later on, some normative orthographic system might have entered into the picture and kind of altered these spellings. That happened quite a lot. If we look at spellings on inscriptions, we can often see right away that actually they were pronouncing things in a certain way that may not correspond to the standard normative spelling that we see in manuscripts. There's other types of evidence too. So the evidence of related languages. So Greek and Latin as Indo-European languages obviously are related to other Indo-European languages. So we can look at those and think about how related words were pronounced and what that might mean for the pronunciation of corresponding cognates in Greek and Latin. We can also, and this next one is really very powerful, we can look at borrowings, because Greek words were borrowed into Latin, depending on the time period, vice versa. Both languages had borrowings from other languages, like Semitic languages. So if we know the source language, and we look at the way a word is spelled in the borrowing language, we can get a lot of insight into how the spelling probably was a way of reflecting the pronunciation of the word that was borrowed in the first place. Well, and then maybe just to mention one more, we have the way the language is developed in later periods. So for Latin, we have the development of Latin into the Romance languages. And as you mentioned, we have for Greek, the development into modern Greek. and we can kind of work backwards in some cases, come up with what the ancient pronunciation was like, using as part of our evidence what happened to the words in later stages of development. So there's actually, if you put all this together, there's quite a lot of evidence about ancient pronunciations. A few things we're a little unclear about, but really we have good evidence for almost everything about ancient pronunciation of Greek and Latin.
That's so fascinating. I'm a bit curious. So obviously today, language, just like any ancient language, is always evolving and changing, everything from pronunciation to just how we use things. Some things that I don't want to generalize, but like people in general, I would say, would consider quote unquote wrong. Like it's either the wrong word or the wrong tense or something, but the trend of people using it so much incorrectly. I've noticed some things have now been added to the dictionary as correct, just because so many people have gotten used to either pronouncing or saying something incorrectly. And was this something that also happened in ancient times, where maybe something wasn't right, quote unquote, but so many people decided to just use it or didn't know better? So did they actively add things to their corpuses of their ancient dictionaries?
Yeah, this is just a standard part of language change. So as you say, after a while, if enough people start to do some things, to pronounce a word in a certain way, or to use a particular type of syntactic pattern, it enters the language. It kind of spreads across the groups of language users and becomes standard. If a dictionary gets written or a grammar gets written, well, yeah, you have to take that into account. The simple answer is yes, all of that that type of thing has happened. And so if you look at, say, a grammar of New Testament Greek, well, there are all sorts of features of New Testament Greek that don't correspond to the classical Attic that gets taught in school. They're not wrong. It's just a different type of Greek that reflects a later stage of development. Maybe at a certain stage, it would have been would have sounded wrong to some Greek speakers, but eventually it became normal, and so we just have a different type of Greek.
Well, that's just one more connection showing that we're not so different after all. The ancients did it; we did it. We're 6 degrees of separation, but we're all still the same after a couple thousand years. So I love having that little bit of connection to the people in the ancient world. I think it's fun to know that, hey, they were doing the exact same thing. So sometimes if we're sitting here thinking, oh, this was strange, why did they add that to the dictionary? Like, this doesn't sound right. We should tell people stop using that and try to get it out of circulation. But you can't fight that forever. So it's kind of cool to know they did it too. So when we think of old language that is definitely a thing of the past today, that we think sounds funny, and while some people might have a pretty good grasp of understanding it, some people might just say, you know, my brain doesn't get this. I don't know what this is saying. So for us, it would be, I'm thinking, you know, some people struggle with Shakespeare. I grew up with a father who loved it, and so I was just in Shakespeare, so my brain, for whatever reason, did not have too much trouble understanding it. But my mother and several of my friends, they needed the No Fear Shakespeare to be translated into something a lot easier. And so I'm wondering, you know, for some of these ancient peoples, let's just say in the classical periods for both the Greeks and the Romans, you know, what would have been kind of the equivalent to Shakespeare, or even any kind of other old English publication? I mean, I'm thinking Beowulf or something that we just, you know, you're like, but it's English and I can't read it when I open it. And I, you know, and then you look at a word and you say, I think I could almost maybe guess what this is. you know, is this something that they also encountered a lot and just said, oh, this would be kind of fun to try to figure this out?
It's a little harder to answer for Greek and Latin because the ancient authors that we read didn't really have the distinction between Old English and modern English, which is just so different. They really didn't have much like that. But there are some similar things. So in general, on the Greek side, Homer would be a kind of touchstone for a lot of ancient Greek authors who obviously didn't write that way, although some of them did, actually. So somebody like Apollonius Rhodius, let's say, was perfectly capable of writing Homeric Greek, but that was copycat sort of behavior. Other ancient authors, they made use of Homer. Homer was a revered author who was highly influential, but mostly very different from the kinds of things that even ancient poets were writing, unless they were consciously imitating Homer, like Apollonius Rhodius. Part of the reason is that Homer's language actually does not correspond to any real Greek at all. In other words, no one ever spoke like Homer. It's a very artificial type of Greek that's unique. It's literally unique. There is no other type of Greek that's like that. So ancient Greek authors after Homer were kind of constantly looking over their shoulder at Homer and making use of it in various ways. But apart from some conscious imitators, they weren't really doing that. On the Latin side, well, there were some ancient authors like Ennius and Livius Andronicus and Nevius, some of whom wrote in meters that were no longer used in the classical period, particularly of the so-called Saturnian meter in early Latin poetry. This was a type of meter that was ridiculed. People like Horace, for example, talk about Saturnian poets in a kind of dismissive way. They certainly were able to understand what the Saturnian poets were writing, so the language was not all that different. Some later authors were kind of critical of this earlier type of writing and had a particular kind of negative stance towards the meter and the poets who were working in that kind of meter. But it varies. So a figure like Cicero, for example, is constantly quoting early Latin poetry. He's a great, great lover of the poetry of Ennius, for example. Ennius would be felt as old-fashioned. He writes in dactylic hexameter in his great poem, The Annals, but it's a type of dactylic hexameter that's quite different from the version that's used by Virgil or Ovid. But Cicero loved that stuff and was constantly quoting it. Attitudes could vary towards the older literature, but the situation is kind of different because the differences between the earlier language and the later language were maybe not as stark as what we have between, say, Old English and modern English.
Quite understandable, obviously. Not as much to go on. We just have more history and more things to sort of base ourselves around than they did. But this does lead me into a lot, actually, of contemporary media adaptations or just creations centered in the ancient world. I've noticed a trend of trying to incorporate more authenticity to what they're doing. So a lot of not new, but shows, let's say, or films have tried to incorporate some ancient languages just so they can have that feel. And I'm wondering if there's a particular show or film that you think has done quite well at integrating or showcasing an ancient language.
I actually am kind of a film buff, but I am having a hard time thinking of films that make use of ancient languages in that way. I know that film by Mel Gibson, I think, that used Aramaic about early Christian, on early Christian themes. Another film which I think in which Mel Gibson was also involved as a director, at using South American indigenous language. So the film was entirely subtitled and spoken in a South American indigenous language. I think that's great. The process of forcing the viewer to kind of enter into this world that's at first maybe seems alien because of the language, but soon becomes much more familiar, kind of riveting, provides a really good experience for viewers. I know there was some controversy with that first film I mentioned, the one that made use of Aramaic. Some scholars were unhappy that some of the linguistic usage was actually incorrect in certain ways. Well, sure, as I mentioned, there's some things we know about ancient pronunciation or syntax, for example, but other things we don't know and maybe never will know. But if you're going to produce that kind of artistic work, then you have to kind of take a leap and go with what you have and not worry so much about the rest. So that kind of thing doesn't bother me so much.
Good, that's good to hear from a linguist, I should say. And I believe, as you were describing them, I believe the Aramaic one was Passion of the Christ, because that would make sense. And I believe that the other one you mentioned was, I think it's called Apocalypto, about the Mayans or Aztecs or something.
That's correct. Yeah, thank you for reminding me. Yeah, that's the one. Those are exactly the ones I was thinking.
Okay, good. So if anyone has not seen them, now you can go find them. Those are the titles. But yeah, no, as you were talking, I was thinking some shows have made a great attempt, and even if they couldn't have actors maintain ancient language for long, because it is hard to memorize and pronounce things, I do feel that some do make an effort and succeed, and I wish more would take a risk. The ones I can pull out just off the top of my head would be, when I watched the Vikings TV show on the History Channel, they did this clever thing where they would have some of the actors speak in what they're calling Old Norse, quote unquote. And then you have some characters speaking Old English. And it was really clever because you would have some extended scenes if it was all just one language filmed and attempted to pronounce in that language. But some when you had characters speaking at each other in a different ancient language, they would start, so you got the idea and you were pulled in that, okay, so now they're speaking in their own language, and then they would either have a translator, quote unquote, a character who you've seen who can speak both languages, and then, of course, they speak to the audience in English, but you know he can speak both, so you go, okay, so he's translating, and this is just accessibility for us, so I'd like to see more of that. But yeah, I think those are just the things that I was that bringing to mind right away. So there's so many more linguistics questions I want to be able to ask, but I don't think either of us have time enough in the world for that. So I'll have to save those questions for a later date. But sort of toward the end of the interview portion of the podcast, I just have a couple more questions for you. And the first one is, when you were an undergrad or grad student, did you attend office hours?
Yes, I did. It would sort of depend on the relative difficulty I was having with coursework. But sure, I certainly did.
And do you have a specific memory of either a great conversation or experience that happened when talking to a professor? Something just fun?
Let me share something that's kind of similar. It's not exactly an office hour situation, but it's a one-on-one course situation. When I was in grad school and I wanted to study Mycenaean Greek, it was not offered as a regular course, but there was a faculty member who was a great specialist on Mycenaean Greek. So I was able to enroll with her in a one-on-one type of course. And so I met in her office a couple times a week studying Mycenaean Greek. And so that was great. There was obviously a lot of interaction, and it was, you know, the sort of ideal type of teaching situation and a great way to learn. The thing that I'm kind of working up towards is the final exam, where the instructor pulled out her handbag, opened it up, pulled out some plaster casts of tablets in Linear B that she had borrowed from the museum and said, "Here, read these." And that was a pretty big shock. I was not prepared for that type of final exam, but somehow I managed to get through it.
Wow, what a practical exam! This is something that I only joked about when I was an undergrad. I took a ancient sport and spectacles class in undergrad. And to try to get out of the exam, we were joking that we would like a practical final. So, you know, we were saying, just give us a slingus and then we'll demonstrate how to scrape the oil. And then maybe that will show you that we know what we're doing instead of having to write it down on a piece of paper. And we pitched that to our professor, and he was a good sport, but he said, yes, well, I would like that, but the rest of the university would not. So unfortunately, you're out of luck. We will be having our normal final. So that was the end of that. But that would have been a bit stressful, I can imagine. But at the same time, that's pretty cool that she even had plaster casts of these tablets to bring to you and say, here, read these. As a professor now yourself, if you were to give like a 30-second pitch for why students should go to office hours, it may be beneficial. What would you tell them?
In a practical way, there are all kinds of benefits that come from developing some personal contact with an instructor. A lot of times, students don't realize that until, I'm thinking particularly about undergraduate students, they don't realize that until the point comes when they, say, are making their applications to medical school or law school, they need recommendations. They've been taking a course or courses with hundreds of people in the class, and they've never gone to office hours. That can be a big problem. You need to develop a personal connection with an instructor if you want to get a supportive letter of recommendation. But that's just, you know, very down-to-earth kind of practical consideration. There's just a kind of engagement with the subject matter that comes with one-on-one contact with somebody who is an expert about the subject. And the other thing is that, of course, it's not possible, it's never possible in any course for the instructor to convey everything that may be important about or interesting about a particular subject. And there's so much more that you can learn about just by going in to chat during office hours about the subject matter.
No, it's great. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I loved living in my professor's office hours. So anyone who has great things to say about office hours, I agree with. So at the end of each episode, I ask if my guest will read Shelley's Ozymandias poem. And then at the end of it, I would be curious to know your thoughts on what do you think about this poem, because this is a poem that has been cited by many people as being quite influential and quite powerful. And so I'm interested to know if you, one, agree with this assessment, and yeah, just two, what do you think of it as a, you know, historian, as someone who can look at it with
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal, these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." Well, that's a great poem, which I confess I haven't read and read since high school. It's a wonderful piece of work. We're engaged in the work of digging out from the sand, all sorts of things like that, whether it's as an actual archaeologist or as an archaeologist of language. I think in a way that poem sort of inspires me to realize that this activity of digging out this ancient material has some value. There are all sorts of things one can find that would not be immediately evident. I take that sort of positive note from what otherwise I think probably most people interpret as a kind of negative assessment of, what happens to things over the course of time.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I read it in high school as well. Maybe earlier, but I can't really remember if I read it before. But I definitely know in high school I read it. And it instantly became my favorite poem of all time. Because I guess since being drawn to the classics, it struck me as quite the memento mori. And, it did speak to me of sort of a political nature of what Shelley was going for, and the fact that it's sort of a statement on the ephemeral nature of power, of humanity, of building things and what will last, and legacy, monumentality, all these great themes. And so the last question I ask every guest is, if we consider the poem that way, in those themes, if we think about our contemporary society right now, do we have a modern equivalent of Ozymandias? Do we have something that we think is long-lasting and amazing and will be here forever and is very powerful, but will humans in 500 years really still think the same?
I think for me, the answer is we can't possibly know that. We can't know the answer to a question like that. We see from this kind of poem and from the study of history that the way we think about current events is not necessarily going to be accurate. I don't know. I'm the kind of person who does not like to speculate. So maybe this goes back to my kind of scientific approach to language that we kind of started with at the beginning of this conversation. I like to work with data. and see where it leads. If I'm led to speculate or guess, well, that's where I stop.
No, it totally makes sense. And I've had many people sort of kick that can down the road because we just don't know. But it's fun to just see and consider. So there's a lot going around. And a non-answer is definitely also an answer and completely accepted. So I did kind of lie, and I will ask you one more question, which is, where can people find you if they would like to find your work or maybe email you with a question?
They can find information on the UCLA webpage, and specifically either the Department of Classics or the Program in Indo-European Studies. So both of those academic units at UCLA will have information about me and should provide email contact. I'm very happy to be contacted by email anytime, and will happily reply to email questions.
Great. Well, we will make sure to link your faculty page and your email in the show notes so people can go ahead and do so. And so I really want to thank you once again for joining me on the podcast this evening for me. It's been such an enjoyable conversation. I always love learning more about linguistics. It is a field that I really wish I had more time to dig into. So it's very fun to learn more through conversations such as these. And I hope that you'll return at some point.
Thank you. Yes, I'd love to. I enjoyed it very much myself. Thanks from me too.
Trireme Transit is now departing Ancient Office Hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.